This is a car park for a prestige building in Sydney CBD. There are harbour views from a bit higher up, but we're underground to see maybe a bit of the future. Part of the car park has been made into a farm, a very small but perfectly formed farm, and the building's tenants love it.
So they come in, they do a 45-minute session on how to seed and grow microgreens. They can pop down anytime they want to check on the growth of the microgreens. They can harvest them at the end of the day. So they really get to see that full growing cycle from seeding through to consuming the produce.
Hello, I'm Richard Adie. This is The Money. We'll go back to the farm later in the show, but we're not focused on farms today. We're not even focused on car parks. We're focused on parking. Parking is weird. We mostly don't notice it except when we decide we need it. We definitely notice when we have to pay for it, because we'd really rather not. Even this guy, Donald Shoup, probably the most influential thinker about parking in the world.
Well, everybody wants to park free, including me. That will never change. You shouldn't try to fight against that. But I think that we have elevated free parking as an ideal as to how to build cities. We've converted a desire to park free into a planning doctrine where nothing new can be built unless it has ample parking. The cities require every new building to have ample parking. And that sounds good, except that it costs a lot of money and nobody really knows who's paying for all the free parking. Because just so the driver doesn't pay for parking doesn't mean the cost goes away. It's still there. Somebody has to pay it, and that somebody is everyone.
That is the crux of it. So do we know how much parking we have?
We don't.
Rebecca Clements is a PhD researcher in urban planning at the University of Melbourne.
There are various ways that we can take a stab at estimates, but we just don't have very good data on that sort of thing because we don't really collect a lot of data around car parking. And that is really one of the results of having all of this free car parking out there that's not being measured in any way.
Do we have a kind of top-end number that people agree on or what?
I don't know that we really have that sort of thing. It certainly varies from city to city. I mean, we can see in Melbourne, for example, we have a lot more on-street car parking than a city like Perth because Perth is still much more reliant on off-street car parking spaces. So there are differences between the cities. There are differences between the areas. In the way that I really look at car parking, I really find it's easy to just sort of ask people to start noticing on-street car parking. It is absolutely everywhere here.
Not that most drivers think that there's enough.
Exactly. You're never satisfied with the amount of car parking that's there. And the extreme example of this is when you look at a lot of US downtowns and US cities where they have far more car parking than we do. It's just a much more extreme version of our cities. And even though the car parks will be largely empty a lot of the time, people will still complain about car parking there because it's not exactly right. Like at busier times, they might be looking for a car park, etc. It has such a psychological effect on people that goes very, very deep for a lot of people. It's connected to, you know, a sense of identity, a sense of power. All of these things kind of get bundled up together and come out as this frustration with the amount of car parking.
So what do we give up to have plenty of free parking?
We give up a lot of what we say that we want. We want walkable neighborhoods. We want clean air. We want less traffic congestion. We want less greenhouse emissions. And we want a beautiful city. But all of these things are in conflict with saying, but we want to park free. You can't have it both ways. You could have a city like a lot of Australian cities, I think, have too much parking. Australian cities and American cities tend to have the most parking per capita and per car than any other cities in the world.
Because the costs of free parking have to be covered, we end up paying more for all sorts of other things.
general goods and services, rents, housing, development costs, all of these things have the cost of parking bundled up in them, even though we don't know it. And that's spreading the cost out to everybody, whether you're a driver or not. So generally speaking, it's making our cities much more expensive, much less equitable, and much less efficient than it needs to be. And at the same time, all of the car parking that we have on our streets, as well as having urban areas that are dependent on car parking, this is keeping people in cars, but also keeping people who can't drive cars or don't want to drive cars from having good quality cycling and walking and public transport infrastructure.
So there's actual costs, which are kind of difficult to track because they get picked up by other cost centres, if I could put it that way.
Exactly. We've got a lot of indirect and direct costs, and we often just don't know that they're there.
But we've also got opportunity costs, because by providing parking, it means we can't do something else.
Exactly, yes. And we've got that in streets, we've got that in our housing, we've got that in other things that we could be doing with land.
There have been studies done of this ever since 1927. I collected about 22 studies in four continents over 90 years. And the average share of traffic that was hunting for a curb parking space, usually free, was about a third of the traffic. Now, that's only in downtown areas where you expect to find cruising. That's where they studied it. But I think that you usually can't tell whether a car is cruising for parking or not. You don't know the motive of the driver. But one of the best studies was done in New York City, where they interviewed drivers who were stopped at traffic lights and asked, are you hunting for parking? And about 40% of them said they were hunting for a curb parking space. So that is driving that people don't want to do. That is unwanted travel.
And the government gets that people don't like this. So in this year's pre-election budget, it allocated $500 million to make it easier to find a park at a railway station. Here's the Treasurer talking about the Victorian bit.
$300 million for 30 new car parks or expanded car parks to bus congestion in our cities and to take 13,000 cars off the road. This is the biggest ever investment by a federal government in commuter car parks.
It was an amazing lack of transport policy, and it was a very, very inefficient and misplaced and misguided use of government funds. So you could say it would deliver about 100 spaces per station in major cities. It's really not that much, but it's very, very expensive to build car parking. It can be up to $10,000 per space for surface car parking and $68,000 for multi-level parking, which is obviously much more expensive. So this is a very, very expensive solution that isn't really much of a solution anyway, and is really not dealing with the actual problems that we have. We have a transport and a mobility problem, not a car parking problem. So this is money that would be much, much better spent on taking a wider view of transport infrastructure. We can do a lot more with things like better bus networks, for example.
On The Money today, we're looking at parking, especially free parking. Erin Inci is Professor of Economics at Sabancı University in Istanbul.
Many people, I would say, object to the idea of paying for parking, but they pay for parking in some way or another. And the best way, to me, is to pay the parking directly rather than bundled with other goods and services. If parking near a housing unit is cheap, housing will be more expensive. That's it.
The economics of housing and parking and how they interact are a particular interest of his.
My aunt bought an apartment a couple of years ago in Istanbul, and she was really, really happy because this apartment came with a parking spot down the basement, which came for free. But there was a little problem. she didn't have a car. She didn't even have a driving license. And actually, she's turning 82 this year, and she has no plans to get a car and no plans to get a driving license. So, frankly, I have been the one who has been using that parking spot, and I'm doing that only when I'm visiting her. So the important point here is, if this parking space came as a free good to my aunt, as she claimed, well, I'm afraid it's not, because land is expensive everywhere, especially dense cities like Istanbul. So the price of the housing unit already included the relevant portion of the land price, as well as the construction costs, by the way. This parking space is under the ground, and we know that construction costs under the ground are a lot larger than construction costs above the ground. So my aunt actually paid for that parking space, and that's certain to be not to be used efficiently, because she doesn't have a car, she doesn't drive, but she paid for that parking space.
He's not just saying that. He's got the numbers to back it up.
If curbside parking near a property is free, residents are going to use that those parking spaces as their own parking garage. Then the cost of those parking spaces, which also includes the land price, is going to be embedded into price of the housing units. So we expect that housing prices to decrease if cities start charging for these parking spaces, which were previously free. Istanbul's case is kind of a precious quasi-experiment for economists, because before 2005, curbside parking was largely free. You can park everywhere for free. Mm-hmm. Well, to be more precise, we had on high-demand streets, we had this informal parking attendants, self-appointed informal parking attendants, operating on those streets and collecting parking fees in exchange for, like, quote-unquote, looking after your car.
Yeah, yeah.
But on December 1st, 2005, this city decided to establish a parking company. And that parking company, as of now, is operating most of the designated curbside parking spaces in the city.
So you've got a before and after, really.
And we got an amazing impact. We find that housing price per square meter decreased by about 200 liras. This depreciation is about 10% of the average housing price.
This deal, this arrangement of free parking, expensive property, doesn't just hold at home. It's the same when you go anywhere, like the mall.
Shopping malls allocate 4 to 6 parking spaces per 1,000 square feet of gross leasable area. Well, how large is this area? This area is usually larger than the area that the developer allocates for shops in the shopping mall. How much do they charge for that? Well, we know statistics for the U.S., for example, in 94% of the cases, shopping malls do not charge for parking. But as I said before, land is expensive everywhere. And when we don't charge for parking, the cost of parking spaces are not going to evaporate. They are first going to be embedded in the leasing contracts, in the rents of shops. And via that, they will get into the price of everything, price of every good and service sold at the shopping mall. If parking is cheap at the shopping mall, goods and services at the mall are going to be more expensive.
This is The Money on RN, the ABC Listen app, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Richard Ady, and today we're looking at parking, which is why I'm now underground with Stacey Agland, who's a lead innovator with Mervac, a company that developed this building.
So right now we're standing in Cultivate, which is a pop-up urban farm in the basement of 200 George Street.
It is the smallest farm I've ever been on, I have to say.
It is small, but intentionally so. So we we're looking at the future of car parks and whether we'd need to deal with them being more underutilized. And we thought, we had this massive idea to turn the entire car park into a working urban farm, but we know we're not quite ready to give up our parking spaces yet. So we used Lean Startup to come up with a smaller way to test that out.
So how big is this?
It's about 90 square meters. It really is just a smaller version, but it's got all the essential components of a working urban farm. So you can see wicking beds in here, which are traditional growing methods. You can see hydroponics over here, and you can actually see aquaponics in our farm walls as well.
So what is being grown here?
Variety of leafy greens at the moment. So one of the interesting but also challenging things about this space and being in the basement is that we grow opposite to the seasons. So we're dark in here quite often in summer. It's even hotter than it is outside. It gets really cold in here. And so we're learning with every week that goes by what we can grow successfully and what we can't grow successfully. The most successful thing that we grow in here are leafy greens and microgreens, which are grown in the farm wall. And the reason is that they have a really quick growing cycle.
So is this all based on the idea that you're still going to be building car parks, but fewer people will be parking in them?
Yeah, so in our innovation program, we look ahead to the future and we look at lots of different scenarios to understand the way that our assets might be used in the future and the way people would engage with them. And there's various scenarios for car parks. We don't know exactly what those scenarios will be or which one will be the ultimate outcome. It's our job to then try and experiment with them and the ways that we might solve for those future scenarios in small ways. This is just one example of how we're doing that.
Okay. What about pollution, though? Any issues with that?
So we haven't found any issues with pollution. For a little while, we did have an air monitor in here and we were checking the air quality. We didn't actually come across any issues. There's other things in a car park. Noise, for example. It is a working car park and cars are coming and going. And always with safety as well, we want to make sure that when we do bring groups of people through, we're conscious of the fact that there are trucks and cars and things coming and going. So there are other challenges. Air quality hasn't been one of them.
What happens to the greens? Are they actually eaten?
They are eaten. So we have a community of urban farmers that work in 200 George Street. They come down, they learn about how to grow fresh produce, and they actually help us seed trays of microgreens. So they'll seed them in the trays, we'll put them in the farm wall to grow, and when they're ready, they either go into the kitchens in Mervac, where our staff can eat them, or they get sold to the local retailers. So the cafes on the ground floor around here are actually using them in their food. So if you pop into the avenue, you can see the microgreens on the menu.
So what's the plan?
The plan is, well, if I had my way, it would be here permanently. But as I said, we take a test and learn approach. So we have another 12 months to see if we can make that sustainable model really stack up. We're looking at installing a growing facility two levels down in the basement. So a really beautiful self-contained enclosed facility that can produce a high volume of microgreens. And we want to expand our network to people outside of 200 George Street as well. Longer term, if we can do that, then we can really continue the building activations as well as produce a, you know, sustainable, beautiful microgreen with no food miles and no packaging.
What were the problems that you kind of had to solve in order to grow restaurant quality food in a car park?
Yeah, so when we first came in here, we had to understand the growing cycles of everything. So it's really not the same as growing in the great outdoors where you've got sunlight and rain and, you know, natural nutrients to help your plants grow. We wanted to do everything in here in a sustainable way, so minimal waste and no pesticides. So being able to do that was a learning process the whole way through.
How likely is it that you might repeat it, this idea elsewhere, or are you already doing it?
So we already are. We actually found some really great benefits from the initial program that we run here in terms of human connections. So we found a lot of people who work in this building and have done for a couple of years that met through the Cultivate program, went for coffee and subsequently became friends. We had a lot of people who just felt a sense of pride and connection to doing something so different. And they would bring their parents down and show them the facility and bring their kids down and really get them engaged. And we found a lot of people were feeling a sense of well-being. So their stress levels were being reduced and their nutrition was being positively impacted. So one of our partners, Westpac, picked up on these initial benefits, and we've run a pilot program with them down at 275 Kent Street. It's a slightly different concept in that it's in an underutilized retail space, not in a car park, but it's expanding on those themes around well-being and community and connection. And again, we've had some great benefits and experiences come out of that as well. So we would like to repeat this in any place that adds value to the community.
Repurposing car parks is one idea, but if we want to ease congestion and get the people who use free parking to meet the cost of it, remember, everybody else is meeting it now, what do we do? Donald Shute says we need to start by charging for street parking and charging more when there's more demand.
It's very simple. A number of cities have been doing it, San Francisco and Los Angeles and Washington, D.C., that they simply say that they're going to set prices based on the demand for parking. And they look at the occupancy rate of each block in the past 3 months, for example. And if the occupancy rate is low, they reduce the price. If the spaces are all full, they increase the price. And if one or two spaces are there, they keep the price, or open, they keep the price the same. So it's based on demand, but it only changes once every 2 or 3 months, but there are different prices at different times of day and different prices on different blocks, just like real estate prices differ. And it's surprising everybody, in many cases, the prices went down much of the day, that especially in the morning. If you have the same price all day long, it's probably too high in the morning and too low in the middle of the day. So when San Francisco did very elaborate calculations, that more prices went down than up.
How do you know if you're getting the price right?
There was a famous Supreme Court justice who tried to define pornography, and he said, "I know it when I see it." So I think the right price for parking is the same. I know it's right if I see that there are one or two open spaces, and if there are no open spaces, I know that the price is too low. So the cities respond to that and try to keep the price at the level that will both be good for the drivers. They'll always see an open space when they arrive, but it's also good for the merchants and for everybody else, because there'll be people using the curb spaces and shopping in their stores.
The next thing to do is to get rid of minimum parking requirements. Rebecca Clements.
These are things that have been adopted in cities mostly throughout the 1950s. In Australia, we really copied them from the US, and the US, even cities in the US, tended to just kind of copy them city to city.
So this is, I'm building a cinema or a shopping centre or a nursing home or something, and if I'm building it and I'm expecting this many people to use it, I have to provide X car parks.
Exactly, exactly. And those numbers are often really pulled out of thin air, or they're based on assumptions that weren't very close to reality. They're often too rigid, etc. They're really not a good reflection of reality. They're obviously not very adaptable over time as well. So what it means in a lot of cases is that you're forcing every development, whether it needs parking or not, to have parking, rather than just letting developments and different users choose what they feel is right.
Of course, this stuff is easier said than done.
We've got two good examples at the moment in Melbourne of different councils taking this on in different ways. Moreland Council has recently put forth a very bold integrated transport strategy, and that's been given the thumbs up now, so that's fantastic. They're proposing to get rid of minimum car parking requirements in activity centres with a whole range of other transport improvements. That's the direction that we want to see places going in. And that's a suburban council. There's certainly other councils could be doing very, very similar things. In contrast, we've got Darabin Council, which was recently going through development of a car parking strategy. They're a very similar council to Moreland Council in a lot of ways. But before that strategy was even taken to consultation, there was a political outcry and a local councillor pulled the strategy. That's kind of a dismal outcome, because that means that all of the problems still remain. They're just not being dealt with.
But there are places, cities, that are getting this right. Erin Ingi from Sibanye University.
Most widely known example is San Francisco, thanks to its SF Park experiment, which implemented this temporal special pricing, and they aim to get some kind of an optimal curbside occupancy rate, like 85% occupancy or something like that, or like having one empty parking spot at every block so that we are not going to have any cruising for parking.
Actually, Erin's own city has been making real progress.
In Istanbul, we have differentiated parking fees across time and space since the introduction of this parking company back in 2005. More importantly, we aim to keep the parking fee for the shortest duration very high. This is what we call the entry fee. Why do we do that? Because we would like to control excess demand for parking or excess demand for trips, if you wish. It's kind of introducing congestion pricing secretly, I would say. It's a nice substitute for congestion pricing, and it's politically more feasible to implement.
Increasingly, technology is making a difference.
When you look at cities like Tokyo, for example, most people are either checking on the web or checking on their phones on an app, and there's dozens of different apps looking at where parking is available, how much it costs, etc., etc. So you're getting a lot of really useful and convenient information that makes things much easier for everybody.
Change is hard. How do you get people to support it?
Spend the revenue on public services in the metered areas. That was pioneered in some cities in California that really were skid rows. They're wonderful buildings in terrible condition, were popular in the 1920s, but had fallen out of favor and didn't have much parking. So when they put in parking meters and spent all the revenue to repair the sidewalks and put in historic street lights and give free Wi-Fi to everybody and pressure walk the sidewalks twice a month and have Christmas decorations, that the places took off, that people wanted the parking meters. All the stakeholders wanted parking meters. They say they wanted to run them until midnight and on Sunday and at a high price. People who had previously opposed parking meters when the money went straight into the city's general fund turned around and said, well, why don't we have them right now? As soon as they learned that the money would come right back to their neighborhood. So I think that this is key to solving the political problems with parking, is to spend the meter revenue in the metered neighborhood so everybody can see that this is what the parking meters are paying for.
Thanks to Donald Shute, Professor of Urban Planning at UCLA, Rebecca Clements from the University of Melbourne, Erin Ingi, Professor of Economics at Istanbul's Sibanye University, and Stacey Agland from Mervac. The Money is produced by Belinda Summer. Our sound engineer is Martin Peralta. I'm Richard Adie. A morning suit can be avoided if you take a route straight through what is known as...